Hello, welcome to another episode of MLB Talk. My name is Andrew. I am joined by Chase, and unfortunately, Nadia cannot be here today due to unforeseen circumstances. She will be back here next week with fervor and energy and excitement. But for now, we will recap the first week of baseball by ourselves. Of course, you are listening to us on UCLAradio.com. And if you want to call us to talk about anything, you can call us at 310-794-9348. That's 310-794-9348. So I wanted to start today talking about some players of interest, specifically players who have done pretty well over this first week or players who have done pretty terribly. And maybe we can extract some information from that, or small samples can just make us look like total idiots. So, Chase, I would like you to go first. You can either give me your good player or bad player, you know.
All right, well, I'm going to start with my bad player because I drafted him on my fantasy team with big hopes. He's a former Yankee, kind of near and dear to me because I really liked him. Russell's from Brussels, as I used to call him, Russell Martin. I mean, this was the guy. He was the first big splash in Toronto's big offseason, and he was the guy. They signed him to this big deal. They were going to put him in the two or the five hole, and people were really expecting a big year out of Russell Martin. And so far, in 19 at-bats, he only has one hit, which comes out to a 53 average. His on-base is .208. His slugging percentage is 53, which adds up to a .261 on-base per sluggage. The most concerning thing for me with Russell Martin is last year, he was so successful in Pittsburgh and had an over 400 on-base percentage because of his ability to put the ball in play. And when you're striking out eight times in your first 19 at-bats, that is not a very good trend, especially for a guy who's, you know, been relying on just being a steady contact hitter throughout his career.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I think he's one of the, you know, that's one of the things where I'd say he's not going to be like that all year. He has always had pretty good plate discipline, so I think that'll still probably play up, and it's disappointing for them. But so far, they've looked pretty good as a team. I think Jose Bautista was off to a not-so-great start, but it seems like he's getting back in the groove of things. And then also at second base, they have Devin Travis, who has not emerging isn't the right word necessarily, but is proving himself to be a useful player. I actually can one-up you, though, on your bad player of the week. I'm going with another catcher, although he's more of a fielder of the outside of the infield. In other words, an outfielder slash DH. His name would be Evan Gattis. And let me roll out some terrible information for you. So far, he is 1-for-24 in plate appearances with 13 strikeouts. That is 52% of the time. And his one hit has been a single. From a sabermetric perspective, he's already been worth, through six games, half of a negative win. If you project that out to 150 games, you're looking at negative 16 wins above replacement, although it's more obviously wins below replacement. So he's been nothing short of terrible so far. And I think, you know, that says a lot about the Astros. They have been striking out at a terrible rate. They did have to face Cleveland, which I admit is a terrible matchup for them because they've got some great strikeout pitchers. But, you know, the Astros all home run, all strikeout offense is not looking like such a great strategy so far.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. And I think for them also, you know, Jose Altuve's been off to a bit of a slow start. He's definitely the anchor of that offense, even though he's a leadoff hitter. I think him getting on track is big. And another guy, you know, a huge strikeout guy, but with home run potential is Chris Carter. He's another guy. He's hitting below 200. He's off to a very poor start. But on the flip side, the one positive I would say out of Houston is the pitching's looked really solid so far. I always say his name wrong. Is it Dallas Keuchel?
Honestly, I don't know. I feel like it's Dallas Keuchel.
But
who, honestly,
Keuchel, like, Keuchel, however you want to say it.
Let's just call him Dallas Kugel.
Dallas K, we'll go with. So Dallas K, through two starts, he's won both starts. And he really, you know, last year he developed into the ace, but there was still the question mark just because he's kind of a ground ball lefty. But even then, some of the comparisons were this guy is a very Tom Glavine-esque pitcher. And at the time, I remember saying, well, this guy is on the Houston Astros. It's 1 year. Give him a chance. But he's really carving up hitters with his changeup. And he's a guy who's looked like, you know, he could be the ace of this Astros team as they continue to rebuild towards hopefully a playoff run. And the biggest positive out of the Astros, did you see George Springer rob that? It would have been a walk-off grand slam, right?
Yes. I mean, a very early candidate for play of the year. I mean, I think it would be really crazy if it ended up mattering at the end of the year, but it's two terrible teams. Like, it's not that. I think, you know, one of the separators from, like, great play to amazing play is, you know, will it affect the grand scheme of baseball? And unfortunately for that play, it was no. But it's absolutely amazing. I think, you know, that it seems like despite the health of the teams, their rivalry, the Rangers and Astros, is quite strong right now. So, you know, definitely good stuff. And they've both been pretty interesting teams so far. I'll say that much. However, you know, George Springer is not really killing it at the plate, nor is anyone on the Astros. So that's a problem. Anyhow, it's time for our good players of interest. I am going to go first on this one. I'm going to take Mookie I'm not going to do it. I changed my mind. Mookie Betts. There's some really easy go-to nicknames for him. Just not ready in my life yet for that, so not going to say it yet. Last game, Mookie robbed a home run, although I will say it's an easy robbery because, Bryce Harper said, oh, he has hops, but he was taller than the wall out there. Did you see that play?
Oh, it was fantastic.
But, I mean, did you really feel like in terms of home run robberies that was very difficult? I mean, maybe from a distance traveled perspective.
You know, my thing is it the most difficult? Was it the most difficult play to rob? No. But at the end of the day, this is a guy who was a middle infielder up until spring training this year, and I know it's easier to go from the infield to the outfield than vice versa for sure. But at the end of the day, for you to develop into what's looked like so far a Gold Glove caliber center fielder after never playing the position in your life, that's incredible. So was it like a George Springer-esque home run catch where we're going to look back at it at the end of the year and go, holy crap, that was amazing? No, but I think it's pretty significant just to show, you know, that he can make this transition, especially when you have a Hanley Ramirez in left field who, while he's been good so far, who knows how he's going to hold up in left defensively.
Right. So, actually, in relation to that, I read somewhere that Hanley put on 25 pounds in the offseason, and early on, he hasn't looked very bad. He's looked pretty decent. I was very surprised. His arm, obviously as a shortstop held up, and so far it's looking good. But back to Mookie, not only did he do that, next time he was up, he reached base, stole second, had the mental wherewithal to realize that no one was covering third on the shift, ran the heck over there, and somehow made it. So he stole two bases on one play, and then later in the game, hits a home run over the Green Monster for a three-run homer. The kid can really do it all, and I have to say, it's extremely early in this guy's career, but for someone who's 5'9", 180, he's honestly got Miguel Cabrera-type wrists in the sense that he can really turn on a ball inside, and I can say honestly, I think he could really be a perennial all-star, maybe as soon as this year. He really can do everything, and I think, you know, the fact that the power is played up this early is an incredible sign for his career. And the Red Sox, I mean, they were already had a great offense at the outlook of the season, but if he's playing, he manages to play this level week in and week out, I don't think there isn't a team that can really do anything to stop them in a three-game series.
Yeah, I'll just give a hypothetical for 2 years down the road for Boston Red Sox fans who are listening. Napoli's probably gone, but let's say 2 years from now, Poppy's still around doing his thing. They could have a lineup where it's Pablo at third, Bogaerts at short, Pedroia at second, Moncada at first, Hanley in left, Mookie Betts in center.
Jackie Bradley Jr.? Oh, because Rosny. Yeah.
Rosny Castillo in right, and then Blake, I'm drawing a blank on his last
name. Swihart,
who's their top prospect to catch.
Yeah.
That could be a very, very, very scary lineup.
That would be insane.
Especially knowing, and we could talk about the Porcello deal again, but I'm not really happy about it, but this year's free agent pitching class, you have Johnny Cueto, who's definitely not going back to Cincinnati. Jordan Zimmermann, who may go back to Washington, but they're going to pretty much have to decide.
I don't see it.
It's going to be, do we want him or Strasburg? I have a feeling they'll side with Strasburg on this one. David Price hitting free agency. Doug Fister hitting free agency. Greinke possibly hitting free agency if he opts out. I mean, the Red Sox...
Which he will. He will opt out.
They're going to have money to spend. They're going to need to go get an ace. I mean, with that offense, you know, the plethora of average back of the rotation pitchers they have right now, and then an ace, I mean, this team could be scary for the next 4 to 6 years.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that you slot Moncada in there at first base. I could see more of him at third and Pablo first. But,
either or in that
but
case.
But regardless, I think that's just crazy. And the other thing I really see is, you know, if I was the GM of the Red Sox, I would say at a certain point, the hell with Pedroia. Let's flip him for some prospects. You know, then maybe you have a lot of choices with that as well. And they could really, I mean, wow, that's scary.
They'll never trade.
I'm scared.
They'll never trade.
This is terrible because I really despise the Red Sox. I really do.
They'll never trade Pedroia. That would have been like the Yanks trading Derek Jeter. It just won't happen.
Okay,
it'll get real, real bad towards the end. And you'll say, why is this guy an everyday player? But they'll never trade Pedroia.
Well, speaking of the Yankees, since we're going to go that direction, things have been not so good so far for the Yankees, particularly the fact that they cannot really pitch. And they cannot really hit. So, you know, I think there are some pretty obvious questions to be made. I'm going to start with our favorite here, Masahiro Tanaka. So, surprisingly, his fastball has only lost about, I think, a half mile to a mile on average on his fastball. Regardless of this, he has not been the same pitcher at all. To quote some very specific statistics that are other markers of injury, because sometimes, you know, a pitcher can be hurt and their velocity is around the same. His zone percentage, meaning the amount of pitches that are in the strike zone, is down from 45% last year, which is already very low, you know, because he gets a lot of chase out of the zone, to 42%. And that's a drastic drop. So that's not good. And in addition, his in-zone contact on pitches that would be strikes is also risen. So, you know, things are not looking good for him. He's still striking out guys. The splitter is great, and his other secondary pitches are impressive. But really, you know, you have to say, is it time for the Yankees to own up to their mistake, or is it just too early? Is there too much hubris involved?
I mean, we talked about this last week. I think you could only watch this guy struggle so much with the secondary pitches when he's forced to throw in the zone because hitters know the splitter's coming. Where eventually, I just feel like if you're Cashman and the Steinbrenners, you just have to own up and just say, like you were saying, enough is enough. I would rather, at the end of the day, lose Tanaka for this year, but then have the Tanaka I know is capable next year, rather than have him struggle through this year where he's not worth much to us, miss him next year, where at this point then you're looking at 2 of the 5 years of his contract are a lost cause. And I think, Tanaka aside, there's much bigger problems with the Yankees at the end of the day. The rotation is just not great.
Chris Capuano is your potential fourth starter.
No, Capuano's not even starting. He's on the DL.
When he comes back.
Although, honestly, I'd probably keep him in the pen. Adam Warren, I think, had a good start out of the five hole. He's a guy who's flashed some potential for a while. I think he could put it together. But other than him, I mean, when Pineda's not on, we're going to struggle because he's the guy who's kind of been the de facto ace. Eovaldi looked better. He definitely displayed the fact that he does have almost that once-in-a-generation type fastball where he's throwing 98-99. But on the flip side, I remember listening to the game and Bob Costa saying the Red Sox had 6 hits when they were down to 2 strikes. And if you're throwing 99, you need to have some form of a secondary pitch to put guys away there, because these good-hitting teams like the Red Sox are going to make you pay. I just got an update that the Yankees are down 3-0 now with CeCe Sabathia on the mound. And to me, CeCe Sabathia is probably the biggest problem I have with the Yankees right now, in that I think he's just ignorant to the fact that he's in the back end of his career at this point. He doesn't have the stuff that he's used to. And after every start, whether it was spring training or here, he'll always say, oh, well, I feel good. Oh, I felt good on the mound. I don't care how good you feel. If you're going out there, and even if you're not walking guys, but you're giving up 4 or 5 runs every start and getting hit around, you're not pitching well. You might be feeling good, but it's not translating onto the field. And I think what CeCe needs to do at this point is he needs to realize that he – not in the twilight. I wouldn't go that far. He could still give you innings, but he's definitely on the back end of his career. And the best comparison of what CeCe should try to become is Andy Pettit. Andy Pettit, probably more so than any pitcher I've ever seen, and it's also a lefty, realized – probably around the time that he left the Yankees for Houston, that he didn't have the stuff he once did, and he completely reinvented himself as, you know, not a junk baller, but a guy who topped out at 90, but painted the corners, hit every spot perfectly. And Andy Pettit pitched up until the 2013 season when he was in his 40s. And I think once CeCe realizes that, I'm not saying he'll ever be the CeCe Sabathia of old. I think the stuff's not there. Injuries have kind of taken that part of his career away from him. But I think once that happens, CeCe can go back to being an effective starter who could take the ball every couple of days and you would feel confident going in. Because I think I could speak on the behalf of almost every Yankee fan right now and say when I see CeCe Sabathia on the calendar, I just kind of assume it's a loss.
I think that's super well put. To look at it a different way, he was a very, very traditional power pitcher. You know, going to come at you with that hard 90s and then throw that devastating wipeout slider. Now the fastball isn't there. The slider command, I mean, was always iffy, so we're not going to pretend like it was anything special. He really needs to, like you were saying, just accept that he is no longer what he was. He's not going to go out there and pull off a Brewer-esque performance. It's definitely time to reinvent his career. And the truth is, a lot of pitchers don't make that change. I mean, I think the classic example of someone who's a very similar thing right now is Tim Lincecum. And, you know, he looked good in his first start, somehow managing to actually pitch well against a revamped Padres lineup. But, you know, he really has not been able to make that transition to a finesse pitcher. Where the secondary, you know, I think the thing that's so interesting about this for me always is that the secondary guys have great, these guys have great secondary stuff. That's what turned them into aces. You know, there are plenty of guys out there who throw 95 or whatever. It's all about how good your secondary stuff is, and somehow they have trouble transitioning to where that needs to be the focus as opposed to the fastball.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I'm not going to sit here and talk about the Yankees lineup. That has enough problems as is. The one thing I'll touch on is Didi Gregorius, man. I know we traded to get this guy in the offseason. We traded Shane Green, who's actually looked pretty good so far for the Tigers.
Yeah.
Throwing a couple scoreless innings today after pitching, I think, 8 scoreless in his first start. I mean, this guy's just looked terrible. I knew the bat wasn't going to be there right away. There was a reason that anytime you're mentioned as a platoon with Brendan Ryan, you know the bat's not going to be there. But even defensively, I mean, this guy was kind of – and part of it might have been the New York media. I don't know. There's always some degree of overhype there with New York and young guys. But even routine ground – not routine, but ground balls up the middle that above-average shortstops would get to, he's not getting to that on the base paths. The first game of the season, he made the last out just attempting a straight steal of third on his own. That's – you know, day one baseball, you learn don't make the last out at third. He just looks uncomfortable out there. And then my biggest concern other than Tanaka is probably Dellin Betances just kind of not necessarily looking like the Betances of old from last year. He said that the mechanics are still a work in progress. And for me, yes, that's a good thing that he's working on it. But my biggest concern is the reason that Betances was moved to the bullpen in the first time is because he couldn't put it together as a starter. The mechanics weren't there. And it just worries me that if this routine that he had last year, you know, suddenly got lost, what value does he have at this point? Because the stuff is always going to be there, but if he's going to get hit around, he's not necessarily as valuable. And on the flip side of that, I just think you know, bringing in Andrew Miller, who's pitched well so far and who probably will be the closer for the time being, it just looks like an even bigger move day by day.
I think, you know, relievers have always been pretty volatile. And a large part of that is exactly what you're talking about, the fact that they're unable to put it all together, largely in a mechanical sense, command. And so I think Betances is such a special case. He's still very young. He's got tremendous stuff overall. It's not just the fastball. If he doesn't manage to fix his mechanics this year, I think he's the type of guy who could definitely have things back together next year. It's very tricky for someone like that because he has a lot of moving parts and it can be one little small thing that's affecting everything. So we'll see where that goes. I guess, you know, the Yankees definitely get credit now for covering their bases, and so do fantasy owners who believed in Miller over Betances. Just going to throw that out there. So one more Yankees-related thing, and then I think we'll head into the break. So Barry Bonds last week was quoted in relation to A-Rod. Most people are probably throwing up just at the sound of those words right there. They are a lot of people's least favorite players. But Bonds has actually, you know, sort of suggested that maybe people shouldn't react to A-Rod the way they have. To quote him directly, anytime anybody in the game does something that's a great accomplishment, the game of baseball should celebrate that. That's in reference to A-Rod being on the verge of reaching 660 home runs and tying Willie Mays for what would be fourth all time. And in addition to that, he also said, no matter what, baseball, okay, I now realize out of context that that quote isn't great, but baseball is benefiting from that person's hard work, so baseball should at least celebrate. Is Barry right about this, or is his argument just so full of holes that he's clearly trying to defend someone who is his friend?
The two things I'll say before giving my opinion are, one, it's interesting how Bonds is pretty much directly contradicting the Yankee stance on this. You know, the Yankees, for those of you who don't know, for whatever reason, in A-Rod's last humongous contract, they put in performance-based incentives, where I think if he passes Willie Mays, he's looking at $5 million, somewhere in that ballpark. So the Yankees are just pretty much trying to distance themselves from this idea as much as possible, as day by day they're trying to avoid paying these bonuses. I've even heard they're willing to go to an arbitration hearing to avoid it. And I also think it's interesting that Bonds is saying this, because Willie Mays is Barry Bonds' godfather. This is a guy who was very close with Barry's father. Bobby Bonds was always looked at as sort of the mentor to Barry Bonds. So I think, one, the fact that Bonds is speaking out about I don't want to say a fellow drug user, but a steroid user.
No, just go for it.
A fellow steroid user breaking his mentor's record was surprising. But I also think on the flip side, Bonds still has the standpoint of the fact that, you know, he's clean in his eyes, but, you know, say what you want, he wants to be celebrated. And I think in his eyes, if people begin to celebrate A-Rod, they might look more positively on Barry Bonds and his record.
So there was one sentence right there before the end that I particularly disagreed with, and I can't remember it exactly. You were saying that Bonds in his mind thinks he's clean. This is completely false. It's not that he doesn't. It's not that he thinks he's clean, that he's been lying to himself. The evidence is all there, I think. It's that he doesn't believe that that diminishes his accomplishment, considering the state of baseball during his era, what he was tasked with doing, being the godson of Willie Mays and the son of Bobby Bonds, a very troubled but extremely talented player who was really on the verge of being the face of the game and never really got there due to drug use. Barry Bonds did what he did because he wanted to ascend heights that no one in his family has reached. And I think that he sees the same thing in A-Rod. And they, you know, they've been friends. They worked out over the offseason together. And I think that he really, for better or for worse, and in my opinion it's for worse, because I think what A-Rod and Barry Bonds have done are in very different levels. But and not in terms of drug use. I'm talking about dealing with the fact that they've done it. But anyway,
moral fiber.
Yeah, there you go. Right. So I think, he's really just trying to say that, yes, you know, this guy cheated, but what he's done is still an incredible accomplishment that not anyone could do with steroids, and that it's, you know, you can't look at A-Rod's drug use in a vacuum. So overall, you know, of course, this is me seeing Barry Bonds as someone who I think is less conceited than people know him to be. And, well, I think it's very interesting. I think, honestly, I think he went a little too far with this, because, you know, to say it was solely A-Rod's hard work that he reached there is just not right. It's just not. But I applaud him for going out there and trying to take something positive out of something negative. So with that, we are going to take our break. When we come back, we'll get to our tweets of the week, talk about some surprisingly good teams early on, and some other news of note. You are listening to MLB Talk, and this is UCLA Radio. Welcome back to MLB Talk. You are listening to us on UCLAradio.com. quick reminder, if you'd like to listen to this show or recommend it to a friend at some other time than our weekly show at 5 to 6 p.m., you can listen to us at UCLAMLBTalk.podomatic.com. That's UCLAMLBTalk.podomatic.com. Not been great on uploading lately, but I'm going to definitely try to push this one out as quickly as we can. And now it's time for the rest of the show. We're going to start with our tweet of the week. So I think I'm going to go first. This one is from Dennis Lynn. It's at Dennis T. Lynn. Derek Norris, the Padres catcher on Giants center fielder Angel Pagan, he was just being kind of a dickhead, and I don't take kindly to that. So I love this quote because Derek Norris is like, I feel like this would have been so great if he was like, I don't take kindly to that, bro. Because I just kind of, that's the sense I got from him on that one. This is in relation to the Pagan-Norris bubblegum scuffle. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah, you got to be careful how you throw your bubblegum now.
I know, seriously. Well, so the weird thing is, you know, Pagan picked it up. It wasn't Pagan's bubblegum. I know that. I'm pretty confident about that. It was in the batter's box. It honestly seemed to me like he was just trying to flick it away. I watched it a couple times because I was really curious. And it landed, of course, right in between Derek Norris's legs. I think he also had another quote where he's like, I don't go out and throw gum into the middle of center field where Pagan's playing. And I'm just like, dude, I really, really don't think he did this on purpose. Pagan was saying that, you know, he just wanted to move forward from it and that, you know, it stuck to the pine tar in his glove and it didn't go to where he wanted it to go. I don't know. Do you feel like this is something that should be a big deal for the Padres, or is it something that will pass?
I've come to learn, as my WWE Match of the Week segment will reflect, you look at most of the jackasses in baseball, they're all catchers. McCann's out of his mind. Pruszynski was out of his, well, still is out of his mind. Michael Barrett, catcher, tried to fight Pruszynski. Veritek hit A-Rod. There's a trend here. I pay it no mind, truthfully. I just think, I don't know, players get frustrated. They don't like stepping in gum, but I think it kind of was blown a little out of proportion.
Yeah, to me, it was just crazy. It was very clearly unintentional, but, you know, hilarity ensued, and for that, it was worth it.
So my tweet of the week was going to be about Yoan Moncada. It was a tweet from the MLB Network saying Yoan Moncada's first game, only one person was there to see it, and it was like some random truck driver. Instead, you talking about Derek Norris just triggered me watching a Dodger game with my buddy Sean this week and listening to Vin Scully. So I'm, you know, blessed at home with listening to Michael Kay and John Sterling, neither of whom I'm a really huge fan of. So listening to Vin Scully, despite his age and Scully-ness sometimes, is great. So instead of a tweet of the week, I'm going to provide a Scullyism of the week. When talking about Derek Norris, he says, I spoke to Derek Norris before the game, and I asked him, why do you always keep the beard? And Derek Norris told Vin, without the beard, I look like a 12-year-old. So Derek Norris beats out an infield single, to which Vin Scully goes, my, oh, my, look at Derek Norris go. He's running like a 12-year-old out there, folks.
Oh, my gosh. That, I feel like the quote I just gave about Derek Norris on Pagan would totally apply right there if Norris had heard that call from Vin Scully.
I just remember listening and just thinking, wow, okay. That was interesting.
Vin Scully is not afraid to make fun of people who are much younger and stronger than him.
I don't even know if he was trying to make fun of them.
Really?
I just think Scully's kind of old and says what comes to mind.
That's hilarious. I have no idea. I guess I just always pegged him as very sharp. It's fading. Okay, well, maybe there will be more good Scully-isms in the future. So moving on, but related to the Dodgers, I wanted to talk about something that I think is superfluous, but in typical Puig fashion is very interesting. So Yasiel Puig, who I excuse me, sorry about that. Got something stuck in my throat there. Yasiel Puig was recently benched in place of Andre Ethier, who's somehow still on the Dodgers, but that's a story for another time, I suppose. Anyways, Puig is rededicating himself to removing his bat flips, saying that he wants to show America that he is not disrespecting the game. And I find this very, very interesting, because is showmanship really disrespectful to American baseball?
No, I think it's not disrespectful to American baseball in that. I think we're in an era where, you know, the Ken Griffey Jr.'s and the Barry Bonds's of the 90s, and even Canseco before that to some degree, Bo Jackson, they ushered in a degree of showmanship, and the fans ate it up. I think fans love to see guys who have no problem kind of saying F you to the opposing team. But on the flip side, I see what Puig is saying in that you do too much of it, you make enemies. And I think the best example of that is Carlos Gomez in recent years. He's a guy who's really – and even Bryce Harper, actually. Two guys who are really intense, you know, get really into every play of the game. But at the end of the day, a lot of people, both fans and players alike, dislike them for it. And I think with Puig, he started to realize that he is going to be the face of the Dodgers down the road. This, you know, they might have the biggest payroll in baseball, but he is going to be the focal point of that team. And I think he's starting to realize that with that and the contract he signed, there is a certain level of maturity that's expected there from fans and expected there from the front ownership. And I think this is just it's a step in the right direction. Do I have a problem with baseball players being showmen? No. At the end of the day, baseball is still a form of entertainment, even though it's a sport. But I think Puig recognizing that the maturity level that he's displayed throughout his career isn't necessarily on par with where it has to be is definitely a good first step for his career. And if I'm a Dodgers fan, I'm definitely looking and I'm happy about what he has to say.
I think these are very fair points. You know, there's a part of me that is going to really miss that side of Puig. And I don't think it's going to be gone completely. But the over-the-top showmanship, the frustration of the other team, I think those were things that aren't in baseball the same way sometimes that they are in other sports. You know, I guess I think about like basketball trash talking, or I guess that also occurs in the NFL. And I think those are some just sometimes provide real moments of excitement, even if maybe it's misplaced and not what the game is supposed to be about. And, you know, I was never happy about, you know, Madison Bumgarner giving up a home run to Puig, but I sure didn't mind the altercation afterward. I found it very exciting, and so I'm definitely going to miss that part of it. Of course, you know, I think he's still going to run into trouble if he hits a monster bomb and, like, stares at it for 5 seconds and then flips his bat 20 feet in the air, but it seems like that's going to be much, much less likely, and for that, I'm slightly sad. I feel like, you know, Yasiel Puig is growing up.
All right, I'm gonna use this as an interesting transition to go from Yasiel Puig, one of baseball's probably biggest physical specimens, to Bartolo Colon, one of baseball's biggest players.
He also qualifies as a big physical specimen. Okay.
I'll preface: Puig is the big physical specimen for the right reasons. Bartolo, not so much. But what I wanted to address is, it's been a while since the Mets have been, I don't want to say a relevant team because I know my friends listening are Mets fans and they'll be pissed off if I say it, but the Mets haven't really been relevant really since they blew those two leads to the Phillies. And even then, they were relevant for all the wrong reasons. But we were talking about who's hot, who's not before. So my hot players are going to be the Mets rotation in general. I think the fact that Bartolo Colon pitched opening day for this team, even though he's probably the third or fourth best pitcher, and despite the fact that he's still throwing fastballs, just doing his thing, he's won his first two starts. He's looked good. His swing looks horrific, but he got the first, I think, RBI of his career, and that should count for something. And even beyond that, DeGrom in two starts is 1-1 with the 1-4-6, but he's looked good in both starts. I think getting the rebound, not the rebound, but the solidification year for him to show that the rookie of the year wasn't so much of an anomaly and that he's the real deal is big. And then, yeah, he's kind of getting hit around by the Phillies right now, but even as a Yankee fan, seeing the Dark Knight of Gotham come back, Matt Harvey, and just absolutely tearing it up his first start, 6 innings, 4 hits, no runs, 9 strikeouts. I was happy to see it, I'll be honest. Mets fans have definitely gone through a lot the past few years with injuries and the Wilpons and just a whole bunch of crap. But I think this is a guy who will not only give the Mets hope, but with Derek Jeter gone, I think you're definitely looking at the guy who's going to be the new face of New York sports.
Yeah, I think he's also got a great nickname, even if it's very unoriginal and just not really, like, I don't necessarily get it, the whole Dark Knight thing. It's like, well, okay, great. New York City's Gotham, we know that, but how is he the Dark Knight? But since when is he the Well, why is he the ace we need, not the ace we deserve?
It might be like, you know, Batman is like meant to save the city. Matt Harvey's like the savior of the Mets. I don't know.
But the city is imperfect, right? So I guess if it's like the Mets, maybe it'll be some kind of trade-off like, oh, the Mets will make the playoffs, but they'll never win the World Series because, you know, he's the hero you deserve, not the one you need. But just like that. Anyways, you know, he has looked pretty good so far. Obviously, you got to love his strikeout-to-walk ratio. Always been fantastic. Still a big concern, though, for me is his mechanics and overall flexibility. I caught a good amount of his first start, and it didn't really seem like his mechanics were that different. And you have to be worried about that, considering how he was injured in the first place.
Yeah, I'll agree. I don't like to give my little brother credit, but he just sent me a funny text pertaining to what we're talking to. If Harvey is the Dark Knight, does that make A-Rod the Joker?
No. Well, I need to think about this. No. A-Rod's got to be like a lesser villain.
He's Scarecrow, maybe. He's like relevant for a little bit.
I don't know. I think A-Rod is more like Harley Quinn. He's more of a like a sidekick. Honestly, let's be real, because you know, just using a lot of power from other sources to help them reach evil heights. So A-Rod's my Harley Quinn. We're gonna revisit this next week. I love Batman. So we're just going to go out and attach as many characters as we can to MLB players next week.
Yeah,
so look out for that.
I'm okay with that.
And, you know, if you want to hit us up on whatever social media and give us suggestions, we'd love that as well. Honestly, this is all I want to think about right now. Like, who's the Riddler? Who's the Riddler? Ubaldo Jimenez is the Riddler. That's who.
Cashman's the Riddler.
Oh, so it's got to be New York specific for you?
Just for the sake of the discussion right now.
Okay, fine. I'd say Ubaldo's a Riddler because you never know what he's going to do. He's got kind of like a inferiority complex. Anyhow, what else is piquing your interest in these final 15 minutes of the show?
For me, it would be the AL Central, the top and the bottom. The Royals, yeah, they lost Alex Rios to a broken hand injury today. And I think that's definitely a big loss for them. But this team is proving that they were no fluke last year. And I know it's a short stretch and people will say, well, what's the difference between winning seven games now or seven games in the middle of the season? But at the end of the day, for you to come out and win seven straight games to start the season, that's not only huge for your confidence for the whole year, but for your fans to prove that was no fluke. So I think the Royals have definitely surprised me so far. I know my buddy Jack, who's at University of Michigan, he's been watching the Tigers. I mean, one, the pitching has been shocking. Because you knew David Price was going to be good, but I don't think you could have predicted that Shane Green wouldn't have given up an earned run yet, or that Sanchez would hold up, or that Alfredo Simone would have pitched well. And I look at that lineup. It's scary. Martinez has proven that he's legit. Miggy's doing Miggy things. They're great. I think if you're a White Sox fan, there's no cause for concern quite yet. But the fact that Samardzija has been lit up in two starts.
Yeah, I disagree. I think, you know, the White Sox made a real good push for this year, and Samardzija blew up in their face. I mean, he's going to be a free agent next year, isn't he? So that to me is a huge issue. He has looked like mid-Cubs career Samardzija, not a Samardzija, who was just, as good as anyone out there, really. So I think that's been a big issue for them. I think Carlos Rodon can't come soon enough for them. I think he pitched five innings in his first AAA start, nine strikeouts. So I think there's definitely still a bit of a strength concern, I think, for the team. And that probably means they're not going to see him until later in the season, if not September. So, I mean, of course it's early. You don't know what's really in store for this team yet, but they're on the outside looking in, especially with the Royals seeming to be sort of where they left.
And a lot of teams also in a similar line like that. A lot of writers picked the Indians to win the division. SI even picked them to win the World Series, in fact. And it just hasn't really gone their way so far. Michael Brantley's hurt. Yan Gomes is hurt.
And now Carlos Carrasco.
Carlos Carrasco, for those of you who don't know, just took a line drive off the head from Melky Cabrera. We're hoping he's okay. But
I think I was reading that he was able to stand on his own. So it looks like he could maybe make a start next week.
But with that team, I mean, there have been bright spots. Trevor Bauer, yeah, he threw 6 no-hit innings with 11 strikeouts.
So you forgot the 5 walks.
On the flip side, he walked 5 guys. It was Terry Francona even said to his bench coach, Brad Mills, you know, after the game, he's like, I'm happy there was a no-hitter. It wasn't a no-hitter because I don't know whether or not I would have been happy, truthfully.
Hey, did you manage to watch any of that start, actually?
From Bauer, I did not.
So I have to say, he has one of the most ridiculous two-seam fastballs I have ever seen.
Oh, the guy.
It's got so much movement.
I mean,
it's incredible.
The guy's stuff has always been there. I think it was just more of him adjusting to big leagues and just willing to be coached to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, his routine is legendary to the point where after starts, he'd be throwing 300-foot pole-to-poles. But I think you have to realize to some degree, yeah, you have a routine who works, but these guys are making 6 figures a year because they know how to keep your elbow in check. So I think for him it was adjusting. And outside of the Central, moving to the NL Central, one thing that has perked my interest, this Friday is April 17th. I believe come Saturday we will see the long-awaited MLB debut of Chris, please God be good, because I have you on 3 different fantasy teams, Brian. I mean, what he's doing in AAA right now, which is basically just hitting home runs left and right and tearing apart AAA, just to me makes – he's hit a couple the past few days. Just to me makes what the Cubs are doing that much more difficult to stomach if you're a Cubs fan, because listen, at the end of the day, we knew that this was because of holding back arbitration here, but – anyone who tries to argue in the Cubs front office, as much as respect I have is for Theo Epstein, that, oh, it was for seasoning, baloney. That's all I have to say. The guy's raking it, and honestly, the Cubs could use a spark right now. Johnny Lester, their $100 million man, has not looked too great. The offense is kind of stagnant. They could, you know, use a little boost, although Jake Arrieta so far has shown last year was kind of the...
Oh, yeah, he's the real deal.
Yeah, he's kind of shown, like, okay, I'm good. Like, there's a reason that with the Orioles I was so hyped.
I honestly, the Orioles are proving themselves to have one of the worst organizational pitching philosophies that there is. Because the approach they took to Jake Arrieta is simply astounding. So, for those who don't know, Dan Duquette has a very strict policy on all Orioles pitchers. No cutters. However, for Arrieta... And I don't know why there's no cutters. I think he correlates it to forearm and wrist injuries, which, of course, can sometimes be related to Tommy John. You know, you look elsewhere around the league. Mariano Rivera comes to mind. Roy Halladay comes to mind. These are two Hall of Fame caliber pitchers who completely dominated on the cutter. It's really the best of both worlds because you can throw it hard and it has great movement. You know, Arrieta was not allowed to do that, and as soon as he comes to Chicago, he turns out to be a guy who doesn't really walk guys, has really, I mean, 3 different pitches. He throws his 3 different pitches with this cutter grip. He can make it more like a slurve or more like a slider, and then, of course, it's just more like a fastball. Honestly, like, this is something the Orioles could regret for a very long time because I see him as a true frontline starter. You add, you know, you have that cutter, and then you add in his really good 12-6 curve. I just think that's... I can't believe that, you know? It's really surprising.
Yeah, and the comparison I'll make with that is Brandon McCarthy, when he came to the Yankees in midseason last year, the Diamondbacks had a very similar philosophy of no cutters, and he came to the Yankees, started throwing the cutter at a great second half, parlayed it into a 4-year, $48 million contract with the Dodgers. And while McCarthy hasn't looked outstanding the first 2 starts, he struck out 18 guys in 2 starts. That's a lot of strikeouts. And it just, to me... Once you're outside of Little League with the whole don't throw a curveball in Little League philosophy, if a guy has a pitch that works for him, let him throw the pitch at the end of the day.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that some organizations just think that they know better than other people about that stuff. And the truth is, like, the only thing you should only really be concerned about the type of pitch you throw if you're constantly throwing these giant breaking balls. That's really it. There's no other pitch that causes that kind of torque. That's really an issue for your arm. So, yeah. Anyways, good pitching mechanics talk. Let's see. What else shall we talk about? You know, this Carter Capps delivery thing has been a surprisingly big deal over the past 2 days. Have you familiarized yourself with this?
I'm Googling it right now, so just keep
going.
So,
Carter Capps is a reliever for the Marlins. Last year, he was pumping, you know, high 90s consistently. Then I'm pretty sure he had to get Tommy John, or he had a severe injury and was out for a while. He's come back, and now he has very peculiar delivery where he actually jumps off the rubber and then delivers the pitch about a foot to 2 feet off the rubber. And in the minor leagues, he's actually penalized for this twice. But he's checked with Major League Baseball, and they've said it's okay. And so essentially, it allows him to throw very hard, but also closer to the batter than normal, which really only plays up that speed. You know, my question to you is, like, do you believe that that should be legal, or do you think that's too far?
This is absolutely absurd that this guy is allowed to doing this, watching this video. To me, he's, with that leap, he's releasing almost a full 3 to 4 feet closer to the hitter. And I know you could say, oh, well, it's my mechanics, but there's no way you can make an argument to me that the hitter is not at a disadvantage when this guy's on the mound.
I agree with that side of it. At the same time, I think that the difference is maybe significant, but it's not against the rules. And I don't know that it should be against the rules necessarily, because he does start on the rubber, and I think it probably affects his command. And secondly, Jordan Walden, who, honestly, I don't know what team he's on now. He's bounced around so much.
Cardinals.
Oh, he's on the Cardinals. He has a very similar tactic. He jumps forward off the mound, which essentially gives you the same effect. You know, you're through releasing the pitch closer to the batter. And he also throws very hard, as you probably know. So I'm not really against this necessarily. I think, you know, it's not really a great strategy. I don't think any starting pitcher could ever do it. And it has very obvious downsides to me, so I don't really see an issue with it. But I thought it was interesting just to, you know, see what other people are trying nowadays. And I guess you're not a fan.
Nah, definitely not. I see the pros and the cons. I just think it puts the hitter at a disadvantage.
I think they should do sports science on this.
Oh, absolutely.
It's too bad we can't. Go out there, find someone who throws 99, and just have them jump towards the plate. That would be scary as hell. Anyhow, we have come to the last few minutes of the show, and you know what that means. It is time for our WWE match of the week.
Alrighty. So, for those of you who don't know me, I'm a born and bred New Jersey boy who's a transplant into the California area as of September. But that being said, New York sports have been my livelihood. So, little history lesson for everyone. Once upon a time, back in an era known as the 1950s and before, New York baseball was New York baseball was prosperous. Where up until 62 when the Mets came, you had four teams in New York. Yes, I know, it's crazy, but the Dodgers and the Giants did, in fact, play in New York at one point. So, with that being said, this week's WWE Match of the Week will be a four-way tag team ladder match for the supremacy of New York, where the winners will receive the key to the city. Now, in corner one, representing, I can't believe I just wrote 27-time World Series champion New York Yankees, you will have Brian. Cross my plate wrong, and I will punch you out, McCann. And Michael, since when does dirt on your neck get you suspended, Pineda? In corner two, representing the lovable losers of New York, the New York Metropolitans. Daniel, how did I end up at second base again, Murphy? And Bartolo, Fat Toad is the new beautiful cologne. In corner number three, our first West Coast competitor, representing the new millennium dynasty of the San Francisco Giants, Tim, you know my money green is being spent on that real money green, Lincecum. And Hunter, I swear I wasn't always this awkward Pence. And in our fourth and final corner, representing the perennial playoff chokers of the new millennium, the Los Angeles Dodgers, Justin, why does everyone think I look like a pirate, Turner? And Brandon, my wife's Twitter is funnier than mine, McCarthy. So, the four corners have been set. The matchup is about to get underway. Who do you have coming out on top, and which tag team will be getting the key to New York City and be reigning supreme as the Kings of New York?
Honestly, dude, congratulations. You are really good at this. I'm really digging it. I think in the future, you might just literally just have you do the nicknames, because I can't get over that, especially the Tim Lincecum one. That's great. So remind me the rules of ladder match again.
It's basically just anything goes. tables, ladders, chairs, whatever. You just got to climb up to the ladder, top of the ladder, take down the key first. You're the king of New York.
Okay. So pretty sure Linscombe-Pence combo is already at a disadvantage here because Linscombe's not very tall, very skinny. Honestly, I'm just going to rule them out right now. I don't think they got a chance. I think Hunter could really do some damage, sort of get in someone else's way. But, yeah, I don't see Timmy. That Timmy really brings them down. So, I guess, I don't really know. What was the second group? I love how I can't remember that one.
The Lovable Losers, the New York Mets. It's
it was Daniel Murphy and
Bartolo Colon.
Oh, and Bartolo. Oh, he's in the mix. Okay. So, and then last but not least, Justin Turner and Brandon McCarthy.
Well, don't forget the Yankees.
Right. I think they're in it for the long haul. You got to be afraid of Pineda. I know he's dirty. I know he fights dirty. He's going to do everything he can in his power. So I like them in at least the final two groups. So, Justin Turner and Brandon McCarthy versus Daniel Murphy and, so many names. I can't even keep track. I don't know. Tell me what you're thinking. Who you got?
All right. So my expert analysis on this one, I think the Giants are definitely at a disadvantage. But that said, I think they'll definitely please the crowd and, the most. You never know what kind of condition Lincecum's coming to the ring in. And I think Pence's bugging eyes and weird mannerisms will make for a great fan favorite. I think with the Yankees, you got McCann and Pineda. You got the two big bruisers. But, for a ladder match like this, that requires a little mobility. I don't know if they're the favorite. And on the flip side, Murphy just, doesn't really know what he's doing most of the time. And I just don't really see Bartolo getting involved. So for that reason, I'm going with the Dodgers. With the reason being, you have the combination of Brandon McCarthy, who's somewhere in the realm of like 6'6". So he's pretty tall. He can throw some ladders around and get up. But on the flip side, you got, Justin Turner kind of low-key being real quick and everything like the utility guy he is. I got Justin Turner climbing up on that ladder, bringing down the key and saying, F you Mets, you never should have let me leave the city of New York. That's why I'm an all-star utility guy for the Dodgers.
All right. Very nicely done. So congratulations to the Dodgers for actually winning something. It looks like we are out of time for this show, but we will be here next week, same time, same channel. This is MLB Talk on UCLA Radio, and thank you for swinging by.
Back by the beach. Still gonna bring the heat.